And hopefully all that will work. Hello, hello, are you hearing me? Yes, I think you're hearing me. So, I guess some of you have maybe found the Brightspace webpage for the course. And if not, you can take a snapshot with your phone of this to get the links to my syllabus and to the course page on Brightspace. The main thing I use Brightspace for is for turning in homework and then returning the graded homework to you. Most of the course is going to be run through this upper link here above Syllabus for ENM1. You can go to that link always to find the latest homework assignment. I'll also have a link in Brightspace to the latest homework assignment. I'll post before each lecture, I'll post lecture notes and the audio. After the lecture, I'll post the audio of the lectures. So one thing, let's maybe talk about a few basic things about the course, electricity and magnetism. Is what we're going to study. And this is viewed by a lot of students as one of the more challenging courses in first year graduate year. That's when most of you are taking it, I guess. And I think there's some keys to success I would recommend. Different people learn different ways. But for me, at least, the way I learn best, your chances of success will be optimized if you try to read or at least skim the lectures before class. Also, it's helpful. There are a lot of beautiful things about this subject, and one of the things I really like is you can learn it all the way down, all the way to the bottom of this subject. That really appeals to me. It's not like, okay, well, someone handed me this equation, I can plug it in under this circumstance. But you can derive it starting from really fundamental basic principles. And I'm going to try to derive everything in the course all the way to the bottom. And of course, there are some places where we'll invoke an experimental result that led to the equations. Fundamentally, ultimately, all this is based on experiment. But another that brings me to another what I think is a key to success in the course, which is try to rederive with a blank sheet of paper all the derivations, especially the harder derivations. Try to do it yourself. If you can pass that blank paper test and reproduce a complicated derivation, then you really know it. Then you really know you know it. And you have to be honest with yourself. At least for me, a lot of times when I was in graduate school, I would struggle getting one idea and how this derivation works, how the math works, what are the concept physically. And I found that simply recopying, you know, the derivation once or even twice, it started to click. I started to see it. And then I could later pass the blank paper test. Another thing about the homework is a lot of the homework problems in Jackson, this famous textbook, were in the third edition of David Jackson's textbook. or a lot of those homework solutions are out there on the internet. They can be found. AI can probably help you solve these problems. I recommend that you don't use those tools. I recommend that you make an honest effort yourself on every homework problem. Struggle with it, because a major part of learning, like how to do the problems, which will later be important on exams, is learning the errors. And if you just take the solutions or get them from your best friend in the course, you're not likely to learn that. And then, in my experience, people who have worked in groups and then kind of, oh, okay, I think I see how he did it, so let's just write the solution, they tend to crash and burn on the tests, which is something like 70% of your grade. So really try to make an honest effort. If you really struggle, first thing you should do, if you can't see even where to get started, ask me or the grader. I'm very liberal at giving hints. You can also try to get an idea from a friend on how to get started if you're really struggling, but don't just take their solution and try to copy it down. Just take an idea and then try to reason the rest of the problem yourself. The struggle is hard, but it's also how you learn. And as evidence of my own struggle, here's my second edition of Jackson from graduate school. I used to get frustrated sitting in my apartment in the University of Chicago, and I would throw this at the mice on the floor when I was mad. You know, I even hit them sometimes, but they just popped up and kept on running. Never killed a single mouse that way. But as a result, this book has seen some better days. I'm sorry?
You should have thrown the mechanics textbook at the mouse. That didn't
work. Maybe that was the flaw in my plan. Anyway, so it's hard. And the first time I encountered this subject, actually, I was an undergraduate at the University of Nebraska, and I got a 35% on the first exam. And here I am teaching you today. I know that won't probably add a lot of confidence. But I think I know the subject now, and I think I can help you. Okay. Also, I encourage questions, by the way. Please, you don't have to call me Professor Green, or like if I were in Germany, Professor Dr. Green. You can just call me Chris. I'm good with that. I'm an informal kind of a guy. And so in that vein, please also don't hesitate to ask questions in class. Please do that. I mean, if you have a lot of questions, I might suggest that you ask them later. But you know, for a clarifying question from time to time, this is all fine. So we're going to be studying some ideas of James Clerk Maxwell. Here is part of his fundamental paper, I think from about 1865. Professor Clerk Maxwell on the electromagnetic field. Sounds very serious. And it's pretty amazing. I don't know if you saw the quote on the syllabus, you know, from Richard Feynman, pointing out that probably in the 19th century, the most important thing when you look back 100 or 200, 300 years from now was the discovery of the laws of electrodynamics by Maxwell. So now you get a chance to really learn this subject, really all the way to the bottom. And I hope I can guide you in that. So now I'm going to try to figure out how to turn off this damn screen. And because I have asked previous classes, oh, would you like a fancy PowerPoint presentation of the lectures? And they say, no, no, it goes too fast. I want to see the steps by steps on the board. So that's how I'm going to do it. Very old school. Not very entertaining, maybe, at times, but I hope you'll see all the steps, and then it will maybe help you to reproduce them yourselves. And now, let's see if I can turn these off. Maybe this raises the screens. I have the sense that no one has ever given lectures this way in this room. But we will do that and see how it goes. I guess that's supposed to be for an eraser or something. Okay. Okay. I didn't print the syllabi because you probably all do it on your phones or in computer. How do I turn that off? Maybe class end. Cool. Okay, so the amazing thing about E&M is that there is a tremendous synthesis of E&M that's developed by James Clerk Maxwell in the 1800s. Here's the starting point. What we have learned from experiment plus his synthesis. Remember, he had to add a term to the experimentally known equations in order to make them symmetric and beautiful and self-consistent. So I'm going to write the equation, and that's a kind of an odd thing about this textbook. It uses standard international units for the first half of the book. I should add new standard international units because they changed in 2016 and in a kind of fundamental way. So the Maxwell equations are, you've all seen them before, these simple equations. I'm going to write them in vacuum, not with media for now. We'll encounter the equations in media later, but these are the most fundamental ones. The divergence of the electric field is a function of position and time, is the charge per unit volume, rho, divided by this constant, fundamental constant, epsilon naught. Then there's the equation for the curl of B. You can create curl, meaning twisting magnetic fields, with a current. If you have a current going in one direction, magnetic fields will curl around the current. But you can also do it, make magnetic fields by having a changing electric field in time. How do you make electric fields? Well, there's no magnetic monopole current, as far as we know. So you can only make a curl of an electric field with a changing magnetic field. And finally, the fundamental statement that there are no magnetic charges, no magnetic monopoles, is expressed by this equation. The divergence of the magnetic field is zero. Let me even label these equations. 1, 2, 3, 4. And some of you may see these in Gaussian units, especially if you take E&M2, And one thing I should also say about E&M 2, which I'll be teaching next semester, is I teach this as a unified pair of semesters. So I strongly encourage you to take E&M 2, either next semester or, if your schedule doesn't permit it, sometime in the future. There's a lot of really fundamental, interesting material in that course. I realize it's not required for the physics graduate curriculum, but these are important topics. How do antenna radiate? How do waveguides work for electromagnetic waves? How do charged particles accelerated radiate? How can you recast electrodynamics in Lagrangian formalism that takes you later into quantum field theory? All of these topics are beautiful and important. And how do electromagnetic waves scatter? This also underpins a lot of quantum scattering theory you'll eventually be learning. So when you do Gaussian units, which is what is in the second half of the textbook, you'll see these equations looking differently. Del dot E is 4 pi rho. Curl of B has the speed of light appearing differently. In these units, E and B have the same units, interestingly, which is nice for relativity, where they are manipulated together, and you can change what looks like a pure electric field into a combination of electric and magnetic fields just by moving relative to another observer. That's equal to 4 pi over Cj. In these units, this equation 3 looks similar, except there's a 1 over C dB dt you need to keep these E and B having the same units, and still we'll have del dot B as 0 is the same. Okay. And the Lorentz, the other important thing is, how does a charge respond to fields? Of course, that is the Lorentz force equation. I did want to say this. These equations imply an auxiliary, what I'll call an auxiliary equation. You can obtain by taking the divergence of equation 2, the divergence of the curl vanishes, and you're left with then del d by dt of del dot E, which is d rho dt basically, and that is del dot J plus d rho dt is 0, which is called the charge continuity or charge conservation law. That if charges in a region of space change in time, it's because current had to flow charges into that region or out of that region. Before I get to the Lorentz force law, I will put up a mathematical statement and then talk about its physics. There's this very simple thing about Maxwell's equations. They are linear equations. Okay, that's a math statement. If you have two fields, you can add them together to find their net effect on any charge. Okay. If you think, how is this affecting us? Well, here is one of us. I was never viewed as a real good art student. Here is one of us. We are being bombarded constantly by electromagnetic waves coming from all directions, from radio stations, from the Wi-Fi in the building, probably from your phone. Some of you have turned on your mobile hotspots, or it's on and you didn't even remember that it was on. Okay? All these are going through us constantly, doing almost nothing to us because the fields are very weak. But if I wanted to know what's happening to some particular charge right here, I could just take up the sum of all these fields and plug it into, well, if the world weren't quantum mechanical, I'd plug it into the Lorentz force law. But the world is quantum mechanically, so let's not do that. Okay, so what is this Lorentz force law that a charge feels in SI units? The force on the charge Q will be the magnitude of that charge times the electric field at the position of the charge and at the time we are asking for what is the force, plus a term Q times the velocity of the particle, right? If the particle has some position at time t, the derivative of that position is its velocity, and the curl with the magnetic field at that position and time, the cross product, gives the magnetic contribution to the force. This is, I guess I'm calling equation 6, and maybe I forgot to call this one equation 5. Okay, so I said it in words, and it's written in the notes. Maybe I won't replace it, rewrite it. Again, E of xt, the electric field at position x time t, B of xt. We often call it colloquially magnetic field, but when we are being more careful, we'll call B the magnetic induction and leave the term magnetic field for H, which comes in when we do electromagnetism in media. Okay, so the units of E could be written different ways. Volts per meter is one way in SI units. Could also say it is newtons of force per coulomb. The time is, of course, in seconds. Rho has units of coulombs per meter cubed. The meter, again, is the length unit in SI units. And J, the current density, is coulombs per meter squared seconds. Maybe I should come and just tell you a little about these new SI units. If you're not familiar with this, you might look it up on Wikipedia or something. But basically, you're in a new era because in 2016, the fundamental units changed. You probably, a lot of you learned, maybe as undergraduates, that mu naught is 4 pi times 10 to the minus 7 in SI units. That's no longer exactly true. It's no longer defined to be exactly that. Now, this is a measured quantity, no longer defined to be exactly. This was some of the things had been defined for a long time, like the speed of light is a defined constant. Maybe I'll write it. C is defined now, because in part we know from Einstein's work that the speed of light is the same in all reference frames, speed of light in vacuum. And so it's now exactly 299,792,458 meters per second. And that is also in electromagnetic terms of constants. It's 1 over root mu naught epsilon naught. And in the past, mu naught was a define constant and epsilon naught. Now their product only is what is a defined constant, and in terms of the speed of light. Some things changed. For instance, the definition of the kilogram used to be like a metal thing in a case in Paris. That's not true anymore. Now the kilogram is defined by some other way. And I don't think I could tell you exactly how that works now. I don't remember all the details. But one of the things that changed is Planck's constant, and I think maybe the electron mass are defined quantities now. Something like that. Okay, so the way we're going to proceed in chapter one here of Jackson. Oh, I just noticed there's no clock in here, is there? Okay, maybe I'll put my watch on the table so I don't go on, drone on for hours and hours uncontrollably. What? Don't do that. Before I was going to start talking about Coulomb's law, but first let's go into media just to complete the Maxwell equation story. In media, there is a, if it is a linear dielectric and homogeneous, for instance, this equation I'm about to write is more general than that, but just to connect it to the vacuum Maxwell's equations. The simplest scenario is you have an electric displacement D defined, which for a linear homogeneous medium is epsilon of dielectric constant epsilon. Then this electric displacement D is epsilon E. And there is, B is related to what I called the magnetic field H by the magnetic permeability mu. Then equation one becomes divergence of D is equal to rho. And equation two becomes the curl of H minus partial D partial T is equal to J. So call that one prime, equation one prime and two prime. And the other two Maxwell equations don't change, the homogeneous Maxwell's equations. So that's electricity and magnetism is these equations. Later, when we're in more complicated media where this is not true, this relation between D and E and B and mu more generally need some additional information about the medium, sometimes called the constitutive equations about the medium, in order to make this a complete self-consistent theory of what the electromagnetic waves do. Oh, I should say one more thing about this linearity. Okay, Maxwell's equations are linear, and a lot of phenomena follow Maxwell's equation, but there are some phenomena in nature where that linearity fails. And one classic example, which you can start to see when you get into quantum electrodynamics or into the quantum world, a classic example is if you fire two gamma rays at each other, they can disappear. They don't just go through each other always. They can come together and make an electron-positron pair. That's one example of a nonlinear phenomenon. It's been observed experimentally. And of course, we know all about matter, antimatter, annihilating the time reverse of that process. So don't forget that Maxwell's equations is not the end-all and be-all of all phenomena in physics related to electric and magnetic fields. There is more, and you'll get to learn that about the time you get to quantum three when you learn about quantum field theory, how to go farther than this subject. And you quantize all these equations. Okay, so now let's see if this board is erasable. It is, but I have to work. Chalk can sometimes be a nice thing. By the way, I will probably post the first homework assignment. You can be looking for it on the website today or tomorrow, and it will be due a week from Friday. Okay, now I'm out of breath. Okay, Coulomb's Law. Let's talk about this. This, of course, was one of the first things that was discovered experimentally. Is let's consider two-point charges in a vacuum. And we could calculate the Coulomb force on Q1. Due to Q2 is a simple equation. I'll write it this way: force on 1 due to 2 is the product of their charges over this constant, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, times the vector from the charge you're interested in the force on, minus the other charge, divided by that distance between them to the third power. And now, what's interesting is that this proportionality of the force on to the proportionality of the force on charge one to its charge is that it's useful to introduce the force quantity, which is the force per unit charge. And because now that would apply to any Q1 that you'd happen to put there. Okay, so that leads to the definition of the electric field as basically this quantity, the force per charge, which we tend to think of as existing even if there is not a charge there, Q1, at all. We tend to think that field is there in space, ready to act on any charge that might come there. Okay, so that's the electric field we're talking about at the vector x1. And this is defined to be E at x1 at any given time, as the limit as Q1 goes to zero of that force on one due to another charge, Q2, divided by Q1. And so that is this quantity, Q2 over 4 pi epsilon naught, and this vector x1 minus x2 over x1 minus x2 cubed Is that writing large enough so you can see it in the back? All right. Now, of course, if there are many charges, instead of just one Q2, the linearity means we can simply add up the electric fields due to all of them and find the electric field at any desired position in space X as a sum over that countable set of charges, QI over 4 pi epsilon naught, the observation point X minus the charge of minus the position of the ith particle divided by their distance from the observation point cubed. Now, we know now that charges are discrete, right? They're the smallest fundamental unit of charge ever seen in nature, ever detected in an experiment. The smallest unit is plus or minus the charge on an electron. Nevertheless, in real macroscopic situations where we have a macroscopic, like maybe Avogadro's number of charges, it's not very convenient to add together 10 to the 23 terms. And then it's useful to generalize this and kind of pretend, or approximate if you prefer, that the charge distribution could be continuous. And if you have a continuous distribution of charges, that sum, of course, becomes an integral. In other words, xi, we will generalize that to a vector, a source vector, x prime. And qi, we will imagine lots of tiny infinitesimal bits of this continuous charge distribution. We will generalize this to dq prime, a differential tiny infinitesimally small charge element, which we can also write as the charge per unit volume at the point x prime times the infinitesimal volume at that point, d cubed x prime. And so that gives this formula for the electric field at x, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, and then the integral over all the source points in the universe, integral d cubed x prime of rho of x prime, and then the vector x minus x prime over the length, the distance from x to x prime cubed. Okay. So that's Coulomb's form expressed as a formula for the electric field. I can sketch a diagram of that. First, define a coordinate system, which I'll usually write this way, like with an x, y, and a z axis in three dimensions. There is some distribution of charge. Let's imagine it's confined to that little blob. We can consider a vector x prime to one tiny little differential volume element. That's my d cubed x prime. And this is the vector x prime to that infinitesimal volume element. Then we have the vector x, where we want the observation point where we want to know the field at this point right here. And we'll have to sum over every little bit of charge in this distribution, meaning integrate, and this vector, which is x minus x prime, will vary as we sum over all the little bits of charge in that blob. And that produces, this one blob produces an infinitesimal electric field along that line. We could call it dE, the differential field caused just by that one point. And I would often label this as point P, our observation point in problems like this. So that's the type of thing. And you can also use this integral form even when you have a discrete set of charges. If you want to do the sum, you want to be as precise as possible and know that there is actually, for any bit of charge stuff, there will actually be a set of point charges. Then we can use this way of writing the charge per unit volume, rho at x prime. We can write that as a sum over qi, the ith charge, times a Dirac delta function of argument x minus xi. And we'll be using Dirac delta functions a lot in the course. I'm kind of hoping you've encountered those before and know a fair amount about Dirac delta functions. Has anybody not in this room, you've not worked with Dirac delta functions? Anyone else? One, another, three? I'm sorry? Yeah, thanks. Thanks. So I have some math review of delta functions, which since there are a few in the room, I should maybe go through that. But let me just say a few more things before I do that little review about Dirac delta functions, which might be useful also for those of you who know about it, just as a review. A few things I wanted to say is that you'll see things and we'll talk about things like in classical E&M, which is what we're talking about here. You'll see things like implied by some of the discussion we'll have about Gauss's law. That charges on a conductor, for instance, take a piece of iron or steel, the conductor, conducting metal, it'll be said that they are on the surface. Really, the outermost surface of a conductor, if it's like a semi-hollow sphere, okay, of metal, the charges would have to be on the surface. That, of course, would be an infinitesimally thin layer. Mathematically, infinitesimally and that's of course an idealization. In fact, on any conducting material, the charges will be kind of spread over some finite size layer. And this might be, you know, of the order of 2 angstroms, 2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters. So it's not infinitesimally thin, but nevertheless, one can idealize, you can try to find their effect if you're doing it through this integral by writing, for instance, rho of x prime as a charge per unit area sigma times a Dirac delta function in a coordinate relative to the surface. Like if it's a spherical surface, you might write it this way. Right, since this is charge per unit area and the delta function has units of 1 over length, this still has units of charge per volume. Okay, so we would use equations like this, like when we're, like especially in the first three chapters of Jackson, making these continuous idealizations. Okay, so now maybe it's time for our math review of Dirac delta functions. I think blue erases better. I need to remember that. Okay, I'm going to go through this rather quickly, this quick review of some math equations about delta functions. And if you want some clarifications, come to office hours. Now I am totally lost, but we'll figure it out. They are on the syllabus, but they are 1:30 to 2:30 Mondays and Wednesdays. And the grader will eventually have office hours. So by the way, this syllabus that I posted and gave you the link to will be updated hopefully soon when I know more, like who is the grader and where is his office and what are his office hours. So that's a real resource. I hope you'll use that. Okay. Review. For most of you, I think, but maybe not all. Okay, so what is a Dirac delta function? In one dimension, it's a rather peculiar function, and the mathematicians would not like me calling it a function. They call these kind of unusual things that we manipulate in physics like functions, they call them distributions. One property is that you can think of a Dirac delta function as a function that is zero when its argument is not zero, and infinity when the argument of the delta function is zero. That's the first of two key defining equations. The second key defining equation is that it's infinity in such a way that its integral is unity. Now, in other words, the integral of this function integrated dx is equal. There are actually three possibilities. It's equal to 1 if c is less than a, which is also less than d. It's minus 1 if c is greater than a, which is also greater than d. And it's 0 if A is not in the interval between C and D. And you have to be more carefully talk about it if A is equal to either C or D. So then you sometimes have to even apply to physics to interpret what the hell that means, that delta function. Okay, so there are some explicit representations of a delta function that are sometimes useful, hint, hint, in problems. One is you can take the second derivative of the very simple function, the absolute value of x, and that is equal to delta of x. Another useful representation that I have used a lot myself is there's some normalizing constant pi to the minus 1/2, limit as epsilon goes to 0 through positive values of epsilon to the minus 1/2 e to the minus x squared over epsilon. Right, you can kind of visualize what that function is. It's a Gaussian that is getting narrower and narrower if you take the limit epsilon going to 0. But because of this normalization factor, it always integrates to 1 as long as you integrate over that full Gaussian. Another similar expression that's useful at times is 1 over pi limit epsilon goes to 0 through positive values of epsilon over x squared plus epsilon squared. That's the Lorentzian version. This first one was the Gaussian version. And another one that we will use at times is delta of x. It also can be written as 1 over pi, the limit as n goes to infinity of sine nx over x. And that is also related to this one, 1 over 2 pi, the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the ikx dx. Okay, so those are some example of explicit representations. A couple of other properties, equation 3, integral minus infinity to infinity of dx, f of x, delta of x minus a is equal to f of a. For a real, need to be a little more careful if we're dealing with complex numbers. And I gave a proof of that in the notes, but maybe I won't go through that. Another equation, or maybe I'll do it here to save space. This is an important identity. Integral, sometimes you encounter not just the delta function, but the derivative of a delta function, delta prime of x minus a. That means d by dx again of delta of x minus a is what my prime notation means. And here is the first time in the course we're going to encounter the first fundamental law of theoretical physics. When in doubt, integrate by parts. This is worth remembering. When in doubt, integrate by parts. If I do that, I will get f of x delta of x minus a evaluated from the limits minus the integral of f prime of x delta of x minus a dx, which, since the surface term vanishes, the delta function is zero at those endpoints, is minus f prime of a. Very important rule. And sometimes that's written as f of x, even when it's not in an integral. It's sometimes written as f of x d by dx delta of x minus a is understood to be equal to minus delta of x minus a f prime of x. Delta functions normally should not appear in any formula that's not eventually going to be integrated. Like if you do a calculation of something that you're supposed to measure in the laboratory, it should never be your final answer should have a delta function in it, because that's either zero or infinity, neither of which are measurable numbers. Okay, well, I guess in a sense, zero is measurable. Equation five. Another important relation, which is not too hard to derive, is that if you have delta of a constant times x, this is equal to 1 over the absolute value of that constant times delta of x. And there is a little more complicated corollary of this result, which is that the delta, the Dirac delta function of a function of x, can be rewritten as the sum. If you think of, right, this delta function only operates at those points where f of x is zero, and near the points where f of x is zero, it has some slope. And close enough to that point, if that slope is non-zero, you can say it looks like delta of ax, where a is the slope. So that immediately leads you to this formula, that this is a sum over all the zeros of f of x divided by the derivative of the function at those zeros, the absolute value. This is assuming only simple zeros at those points, meaning there's a non-zero slope. So for instance, you'll encounter expressions like delta of x minus a times x minus b, and this is 1 over absolute value of a minus b, delta of x minus a plus delta of x minus b. You should be able to derive that. We'll also encounter a little more complicated scenario with delta functions in multiple dimensions. So, like delta of x minus x prime, if you wanted to write this in Cartesian coordinates, you could just take the x component, coordinate 1, minus x1 prime times delta of x2 minus x2 prime times delta of x3 minus x3 prime. If 1, 2, and 3 are like the x, y, and z axes. Of course, this vanishes everywhere in space, this three-dimensional case of a delta function, it vanishes everywhere in the universe except at the point where x is equal to x prime. And its volume integral over the region containing the delta function with a volume element d cubed x prime is, of course, 1 if x is in that volume, the volume v, and it's 0 if it's not. There are also three-dimensional representations of delta functions. I should make sure I'm on track of the time. Okay, 10 o'clock. Which you can generalize from our one-dimensional representations. This is an important one. It's used a lot in quantum mechanics. It's 1 over 2 pi cubed integral d cubed k e to the I k dot x minus x prime. It's one way to write a three-dimensional delta function. It's also sometimes important. We'll do problems in different coordinate systems, in Jackson, cylindrical coordinates, spherical coordinates. If I'm feeling ambitious, I might even do prolate spheroidal coordinates. Then you can go to general curvilinear coordinates that are orthogonal. There are, I forget, 8 or 11, it's in Morrison-Feshbach, how many such coordinate systems exist. Let's call the generalized coordinates Q1, Q2, Q3. If you want to think of an example, think of your spherical coordinates r, theta, phi that define a right-handed coordinate system. And what is important is to be able to, first thing, if you're going to do any work in a set of curvilinear coordinates that are not Cartesian, you'll want to know the differential arc length formula, which is usually written this way, is the distance between two points infinitesimally close has a scale factor h1 that depends on those coordinates in general times d, the differential square of that coordinate. And then similarly for each h2 squared dq2 squared plus h3 squared dq3 squared. And the volume element in those coordinates, d cubed x, is also written in terms of these h factors that you have to look up for whatever the coordinates you're working with. H1, h2, h3, dq1, dq2, dq3. And then I can use what I learned there to write the delta function, three-dimensional delta function, in general curvilinear coordinates. Which you'll need when we get to chapters 2 and 3 of the book. Oh, it seems I probably made a butt dial. That's always fun. Okay. Wonder who been called. Okay, a 3D delta function in general curvilinear coordinates, delta x minus x prime, I could write as 1 over h1, h2, h3, delta of q1 minus q1 prime, delta q2 minus q2 prime, delta of q3 minus q3 prime. And so, for instance, a common case we'll see a lot is spherical coordinates, spherical polar coordinates in three dimensions, right? Our x, y, z. We have a point r, and r itself is the length of that vector. We project it down onto the xy plane, and we have an angle phi relative to the x-axis, and relative to z, we have theta. That's how physicists write spherical coordinates. I think mathematicians do it in some other way that mystifies me. So the 3D delta function in spherical coordinates, as one example, where HR is 1, H theta is 1, and H phi is sine theta. I think that's right. No, R sine theta and R. Is that right? I think that's right. Yeah, then we get delta of r minus r prime, delta of theta minus theta prime, delta of phi minus phi prime, all over r squared sine theta. Another way of writing this, which I find useful sometimes, is just to write it 1 over r squared, delta r minus r prime, delta of cos theta minus cos theta prime, delta of phi minus phi prime. You should be able to convince yourself that these two expressions are identical. Another identity, and we'll be using this soon, about delta functions that's useful, is, I guess I called this item 7. Is del squared of 1 over r is minus 4 pi Dirac delta function of the vector r. Let's see, where am I? I think that's all I wanted to say about delta functions. Again, if that is all Greek to you, this course might be a struggle, okay? Because we're going to do so much with delta functions, so you better really get comfortable with these relations. They kind of have to be on the back of your hand as you're doing a lot of the work in chapters 1 through 3, especially. Okay, so we're ready to talk about Gauss's law. I don't have a lot of time left, but let me at least set this up. So we have a law for calculating an electric field in static situations where you have been given a set of charges. You want to find the electric fields. So Gauss's law is an often more convenient way than doing the Coulomb's law integral I wrote earlier. Although it's a little limited because you need usually a very simple geometry to be able to apply it. But it also has some intuitive power that we can use for various pieces of reasoning we're going to need to do at times about electric fields. So basically, we're going to reinterpret a math formula, and it will have a lot of physical and intuitive power. Okay, so let's imagine a point charge in space, just one charge. And we're going to draw an imaginary closed surface around that charge. In this and coming chapters, we're going to think a lot about imaginary surfaces and the volume they contain. And if it's a completely closed surface, like it would hold milk, right, then we call it a closed surface. Sorry, I just realized this is probably blocking some of your views. Is that right? Or can you see?
No, you? But it's okay. You can have
your
notes, so that's fine.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll draw my picture over here. Okay, so here we've got our cue. Here I've got my closed surface S. Enclosing it. And inside of that closed surface is what I'll call the volume V. Okay, so some volume V, and it's got some surface around it. And now I'm going to look at the vector from the point Q out to the surface. Say some surface point here. And there is some differential surface area element I'll call dA at this point. And there is a normal to the surface at that point. Let's say, just looking here, n hat is the normal. dA is the differential area element of that little tiny piece of the surface. N hat is the normal to the surface at that point, wherever the surface is pointing, unit vector. And the electric field at that point, we know from Coulomb's law, will be pointing directly along this vector r to that point on the surface. That would be the differential electric field, or I guess I should just call it E because it's not differential, at that point is maybe pointing in that direction. And there could be an angle theta here between the normal and the electric field, depending on, you know, the shape of the surface and where the normal is. And when I call this a unit normal, don't forget, it's defined to be the outward pointing out of the surface. It's important to get all our signs correct in some of the integrals we'll be doing in the next few weeks to keep track of the direction. Okay, so we can write geometrically what E dot dA is easily enough. That will be Q over 4 pi epsilon naught r squared at this point times cosine theta from the dot product of n hat with E and then times the magnitude dA. But now here's a little bit of geometry. There is a solid angle subtended by this tiny differential area element looking from Q. I'll call that solid angle element subtended by dA from the point of view of Q. That is cos theta dA over r squared. So that means that we can write the integral of E dot dA, if we integrate that over the entire surface for this one position of the charge, which I'll indicate with a closed integral because it's a closed surface. We are integrating over every single point in this closed surface. This is equal also to the surface integral of Q over 4 pi epsilon naught d omega, integrating over all solid angles. But if you integrate over all solid angles around you, that's always equal to 4 pi. Right? 4 pi, there are 4 pi steradians if you go around to integrate over all the angles of a sphere. And it's not just a sphere, it's over all the solid angles, no matter what coordinates you're in. And so that means the key result is that the integral of E dot dA for a point charge is also equal then to this Q over 4 pi epsilon naught d omega, which is Q over epsilon naught if Q is in V, is in the volume somewhere, and it's zero if not, if it's not in the volume. Oh, I've gone over time. Some of you should have told me that. We'll stop there and I'll generalize this to the more general statement of Gauss's law next time. And see you on Thursday.